From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Simon Winchester is the British-born writer, traveler, and broadcaster. His books include The Professor and the Madman. His most recent book is called Skulls, and it's a fascinating look into the mystery and the science of the bones that cover our brains. Simon Winchester has worked as a field geologist, a correspondent for the London Times. For the Guardian newspaper, he covered Northern Ireland and Washington, D.C. He spent time in jail in Tierra del Fuego during the Falkland Islands conflict. His hobbies include letterpress printing, beekeeping, and cider making. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
So Skull focuses on photographs of Alan Dudley's extraordinary collection of both human and animal skulls. How did you tumble to Alan Dudley? How did you find out about him?
Well, a friend of mine in London who makes apps for the iPad rang up one day and said, have a look at the Daily Mail today. Now, the Daily Mail is, as you probably know, the most popular online newspaper in the world. It's also one of the most irresponsible and badly written newspapers in the world, too. But they had a story saying, you know, 56-year-old man arrested in Coventry for having, basically for having skulls he shouldn't have. And it was about this man who lives a life, his profession is to select the veneer for the dashboards of Jaguar motor cars. I mean, who knew that there was a chap with such a profession, but that's what he does in the daytime. And it turned out that he had amassed over the years in a very ordinary suburban house in an extremely ordinary English town, Coventry, probably the biggest and most taxonomically comprehensive collection of skulls anywhere on the planet, certainly any privately held collection. 3,000-odd. I mean, there are, 58,000 species that have skulls, and divided between, you know, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, birds and fishes. And he, Alan, had a comprehensive bunch of each of those five classes, but he had strayed accidentally, I now think, and the court agreed, by buying a howler monkey, a penguin, a chimpanzee, and a marmoset, which trade in which is banned under the CITES convention. So this friend of mine that rang me said we should make an app about this man's amazing collection. But we thought what we really want to do is to be old-fashioned and produce a book. And so a publishing house in New York, Black Dog, came along and have produced this absolutely extraordinary, I think it's a very beautiful book. It's a bit of a departure for me, but I really became very engaged in it.
And this is the first time a lot of these pictures of these skulls have been seen publicly. He's got this extraordinary collection. Is it not well known among people who know skulls?
Well, I think among the small subset of people that know skulls, yes, I think Alan Dudley's quite famous, but I turned up in the street that he lives in and obviously had the wrong number for him and hammering on a number of doors very close to his. And you'd think he'd have some sort of local notoriety. And people next door said, no, I've no idea. There's a bloke next door that's got skulls. I said, yes, the biggest skull collection in the world is right next door to you.
In his second bedroom.
Yes, basically. I don't want to get super grotesque about this, but the way he prepares the skulls is he basically puts the head of an animal in a bucket of cold water. It's called cold water maceration, and leaves it there for several months, and the water goes black and extremely smelly while the bacteria do their work.
You found out the maggots were too rough.
Maggots are too rough. They're really aggressive. They have a feeding frenzy and so damage the more delicate bones, the internal nasal bones of skulls. But the smell pervaded the house, which caused his wife to leave him. So all of a sudden, a bedroom became free, and he filled that up with skulls. So it's sort of outwardly rather sad portrait of this now lovelorn man with surrounded by these rather macabre artifacts. But they're so beautiful, and his knowledge of them is profound.
And as are the photos. Simon Winchester, as you point out, there's sort of a checkered history of people who study skulls. When it comes to Alan Dudley, is he kind of squarely in the scientific realm?
No, I think Alan, at least initially, just became enthralled by things that when you remove the flesh and the fur, his first ever animal was a red fox. And certainly when you look at the picture of the red fox skull in the book, you think this is a thing of uncommon beauty with all the parts of it, you know, the rostrum and the cranium and the mandible and the zygomatic arches and the sagittal ridge and all the things that a scientist would readily identify. And he thought he'd simply collect them as one might collect matchboxes or, you know, beer bottles or whatever. But then he got more scientifically interested and then became an authority. Mm-hmm. And zoos all over the country and indeed all over the world would say, look, we've got a hippopotamus that's dying once it's you know, popped its clogs, but you come and take its head off and and we'll turn it into a skull. And he did. And so his collection is now world class, and people come to him now.
But some people who've studied skulls have done it kind of in an anti-scientific sense, too, as you recount.
Well, yes. I mean, we as humankind venerate the skull and indeed collect it and use it in all sorts of ways. I mean, artistically, and I dwell a lot, for instance, on the famous Holbein photograph, rather piece of art called The Ambassadors, which has this peculiar smear across the bottom of it, which if you jiggle the picture, well, it's difficult to jiggle because it's 7 feet by 7 feet, you can see it turns into a skull. It's a magical thing to see.
It just looks like a smear in the painting, but then when you look at it, why is the skull there? It's just fascinated artists.
It is, and it's what they call a memento mori, a reminder of death, that however grand the portrait of these two ambassadors who are clad in ermine and jewels and things, that they're going to die. I look at things like that, and I look at the weird scientific, the role that the skull is played in weird pseudoscience, things like phrenology, where these crazy German scientists came up with the idea that if you became very good at, let's say, calculation, or if you were good at seducing people, the part of your brain that did that would grow enormously. It would bulge and cause your skull to bulge. So there's that sort of thing. And craniometry, the measurement of the skull, which made an American called Morton come to conclusions about racial differences in skulls, from which he created a hierarchy, mm-hmm. showing that there were the so-called dolichocephalic skulls possessed by Aryans, which were superior to the brachycephalic skulls possessed by Jewish people.
And the symbolism is so varied and so omnipresent. I just took some skulls down off my window lately finally after Halloween. I took the skulls down. And alas, poor Yorick and Hamlet,
yes.
and the Grateful Dead. Their symbol is a skull. Have skulls always held such fascination for humans?
They really have. I mean, you go to the oldest of middens and grave sites and you find that, you know, where you might say, why don't we revere the pelvis? That is, after all, where life comes from. Why the skull? And it's because even though people 5,000 years ago didn't really recognize what the gray matter inside it did, clearly that is the locus of thought and feeling. And of course, the sense organs are there and you speak out of it and you see through the holes in it and smell things through it and taste things through it. So it was clearly a very, very important part of the human body.
Simon Winchester, his most recent book is called Skulls. It's been a pleasure.
It's been fun. Thank you. There is a world inside the world. There is a world inside.
Science writer Richard Panik tries to explain the mystery of the world inside the world in his new book called The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality. It's about developments in the last decade in our understanding of the cosmos. Richard Panik received a Guggenheim Fellowship in science writing. He writes about astronomy and cosmology for the New York Times, Discover, Esquire, and other publications. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
What is this 96% of the universe made up of something other than the matter that we know?
Well, if you find out, book yourself a flight to Stockholm. 23% is something called dark matter, and 73% is something even more mysterious called dark energy.
See, here's what I don't understand. If we don't know what it is, how could we know that 23% of it is this and 73% of it is that?
Well, let me back up for a moment.
Sure.
Because when I first started hearing about this 10 years ago, that was pretty much my response too. And over the weekend, I was in D.C. at the Air and Space Museum signing some copies of the book, and the cashier read the inside flap and said, "That's crazy," which I thought was a great response. I mean, completely appropriate and very gratifying to me because it does sound crazy. But there are good reasons to think that astronomers have it right. And believe me, they tried to convince themselves that they were wrong because it's just too wild an idea. But basically, the idea is that 23% is dark matter. Now, they think that dark matter is there because if you look at the motions of galaxies, the way they spin around, they appear to be spinning too fast for their own good. They should be shredding apart at the rate that they're spinning. And that's true even of the Milky Way galaxy, our own galaxy. However, those observations begin to make more sense if you say there's something else there that's stabilizing the galaxies gravitationally. Okay, so that's 23%. We'll get to the numbers in a moment, like how they got to the numbers. In the late, throughout the 1990s, two teams were trying to figure out how much the expansion of the universe is slowing down because you have all this matter in it. Now you have dark matter in it. They figured out in the 1970s. So they're trying to figure out how much the expansion is slowing down since there's...
And we should explain it's the Big Bang.
Yeah, it's the Big Bang.
Everything was going outward, so naturally it would slow down. They're trying to figure that out.
Right, because there's all this mass and it's interacting gravitationally. And you say, okay, is it slowing down so much that eventually it will recollapse? Or is it slowing down just enough that it'll kind of peter out? Well, what they found to their astonishment and to the astonishment of scientists everywhere is that the acceleration is not slowing down or not evening out, but it's speeding up, which means that there's something on a cosmic scale that is outperforming gravity. And that they call dark energy.
We're talking with Richard Panik, and his book is called The 4% Universe. And it kind of contains this difficult to grasp notion that a lot of what is made up in the universe is something that we don't even know what it is. And it's called dark in the sense that it's pretty much unknown. You write that this really isn't the first time we learned that the majority of the universe is hidden from us. In fact, it happened several centuries ago.
That's right, with Galileo. Galileo got his hands on one of the first telescopes, and when he pointed it at the night sky, he saw that there were things that nobody had ever seen before, like moons around Jupiter or other stars that we hadn't seen. And since then, a lot of astronomy has been this kind of outward progression of finding more and more. And so you find more stars, you find more planets are discovered over the past few centuries. You eventually figure out that all the stars that we see are not the entirety of the universe, but in fact, it's just this one, what they used to call an island universe. Now we would call it a galaxy, and that there are other galaxies out there, 100 or 200 billion of these galaxies. So that's, you know, that's what Galileo, the revolution that Galileo began. And then in the 20th century, some astronomers were looking in radio waves and X-rays and things outside of the optical, and they found that there, too, there was more than meets the eye. But now the thing about dark matter and dark energy is that you can look anywhere on the electromagnetic spectrum and you don't see them. So this is dark as in beyond seeing. It's not black holes or anything like that. It's beyond what we can see, beyond anything we can access through our senses.
Now, we can measure matter, and we can measure energy, and we can even measure gravitation. Why can't we measure dark matter and dark energy? Why can't we figure out more about it?
Well, we can measure their proportions. So we can do that. Would you like me to explain how?
Yes.
Okay, great. So if you look, there's something called the cosmic microwave background, which is what happened in the early universe when matter and energy went their separate ways. And this is mapped on the sky. It was discovered in the 1960s. In the past two decades, the measurements of this cosmic microwave background have become much more refined. And remember, what we're seeing there is when matter and energy went their separate ways. So you can see the proportions of matter and energy. When they make these very close observations of the cosmic microwave background, and they've done this again and again and again, and then you run computer simulations of millions of universes and say, well, this universe has 100% matter and 0% energy. This universe has 23 and blah, blah, blah. And when they run those numbers, the one that matches is the one that has 23% dark matter, 73% dark energy, and 4% the stuff of us. And these are, I mean, and they've really narrowed down these numbers. And in fact, these experiments are what have convinced a lot of people who are very resistant to the idea that there's something there.
The book is called The 4% Universe. This reminds me of something my mother used to tell me. She said, the more I learn, the less I know. I mean, does that apply to what scientists are finding out the deeper they get into these measurements?
Yeah, it's actually one of the thrilling things in science. And I want to say that this book is very much a human story. It's not just about these concepts, that there are all these characters, they're the scientists, and it's really told from their point of view and how they came to these conclusions. And what I found in following them in this close manner is that they are thrilled by this. I mean, at first they say, well, we don't understand this, and they have to convince themselves that they're not making some error of some sort. But then as they become convinced, this is mentioned in the book. I saw an astronomer get up at a conference once, and he said, if you put the whole timeline of science in front of me, this is where I'd want to be, because this is the greatest challenge we've seen. When you find out that most of the universe is missing. But this concept is so new that even, I'm sure among your listeners, the science literate listeners know about dark matter and dark energy. They've heard the terms, but the full impact is known in the scientific community that this is something revolutionary. This is really new, and it's really big, and it's really profound, but that word hasn't really gotten out yet.
There are some just sentences in this book that I just had to stop and think about a lot. Apparently, a lot of these discoveries pose some challenges to how we understand gravity. And there's one line in your book that says something like, theorists propose that gravity is a relic from a parallel universe. And my mind began to spin from reading that line. What does that mean?
Well, you know, gravity is one of those great placeholders in science. We don't know what it is, okay? I mean, we know how it behaves. We can work out the math for how it behaves, but we still don't know what it is. And it's weaker than the other three forces in the universe. I mean, spectacularly weaker, and there's no reason that it should be that weak. So some theorists are thinking, well, maybe there is a parallel universe. You know, to go back to the previous caller, if there was inflation, then there would be all these bubbling universes that would be out there, and ours would just be the one that happens to have 73% dark energy, 23% dark matter, and 4% everything else. If that's the case, then according to some theorists, these parallel universes could be leaking gravity into ours. I mean, or they could have an attractive force, and that's what we perceive as gravity. I mean, this is extraordinarily speculative at this point, but it does, that sentence in the book, I hope, illustrates the point that this is how baffled they are, that they're trying to come up with, you know, anything that sticks to the wall.
Richard, you're obviously a pretty smart guy, but you're talking with people who kind of were working on this for 10 years.
Yeah.
And in many places, it's clear from your description, it kind of baffled them and
oh, yeah,
extended their belief. Could they talk to you in a way that was it hard to get the information from them to write this book?
I should say that I'm not a scientist. I don't have a background in science. I'm a writer. I have a background in fiction and in journalism. And what I try to do is take my ignorance and use it to my advantage so that I feel like I'm starting out where the reader starts out. And if I, you know, I'm kind of the conduit between these people who have done it all their lives and people who are just beginning to think about it. So yes, they were very generous with their time and their information, and they're very talented at explaining it. Yeah,
good. Richard Panik, the book is called The 4% Universe. He's already also very good at explaining it. The subtitle: Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Ali Ferguson. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is KUOW 94.9 Seattle.